Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the silky smooth sounds of the Green and Red podcast, our first episode of 2022. I am your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California. And as always, I am joined by...
I thought it was the Honorable.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm the Honor... And today, actually calling ourselves the Honorables is going to be particularly relevant because... You know, you only really get called the Honorable Scott Parkin if you've been confirmed by the Senate. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Senate today.
Right.
But as always, I'm joined by...
I've always been more dishonorable than not, but I will call myself the Honorable Bob Bazanko today. I am in Ohio for the time being, ready to head back to Texas, which I can't wait for. So, and always, you know, we always start with a big thank you. And especially now, we have seen a very significant uptick just in the last kind of 6 weeks, 2 months or so in the number of listeners we had. It's something we've been working on for a long time. So for those of you who have been with us for the long haul, the people who are comrades and in the M19 Brigade and just regular listeners, we thank you and ask you to continue supporting us, which means you share this or you rate and review it or you subscribe or do whatever it needs to you can. For the new people, you know, we would suggest that you go back and listen to some of the older shows if you're so inclined, because we've been doing some really good stuff for almost 2 years now, actually. You know, again, please share it, put it out there on your social media and tell people about it. And we've also seen a nice improvement, increase in donors and people who are financially supporting us. And so we would like to see that continue. We have a little bit of overhead. We would like to get some better equipment this year, maybe a laptop that actually works better with video and maybe some good mics and things like that. So
satellite dish. We're looking for
satellite dish. We're going to try to break into the, you know, kind of go after like Al Jazeera and Reuters and, you know, all those kinds of people too. So if you want to do that, if you want to help us out with a small donation or a bigger one, whatever nickels you can put together, we would really appreciate that. And you can do that in a couple different ways.
Yeah, I'll say that if you want to make a donation, you can go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit that share button. Much love and appreciation to everyone who did a end of the year, who supported our end of the year fundraising. We raised a good bit of money. Or you can become a patron at patreon.com/greenandredpodcast. And you know, there's different tiers that we have in there. 20 and over, $20 and over a month of actually pushing the M19 Brigade. And I'm actually excited to say that we had two new members of the M19 Brigade join us this weekend. And so, you know, we're not one of those podcasts that have 1.2 million followers on YouTube or whatever, and, you know, pay for all sorts of things, but we are like scrappy and appreciate like everyone who's out there supporting us. We put a lot of heart and passion into this work, and appreciate everyone who has been listening to us from the beginning and everyone who's been joining us recently. So just want to say that. And then today we are going to our first episode of 2022. We're going to actually, it's an anniversary of sorts. We're going to actually talk about the anniversary of the Capitol riot, which happened a year ago. And we at Green and Red like to talk about things in a different sort of way. A lot of the press and all of the, you know, remember when articles that you're going to see about the Capitol riot are going to be about Trump being a fascist or the Republicans being a cult around Trump and, you know, a bunch of coup, you know, plotters or whatever. And we're going to talk about things a little bit differently. The historian Arno Mayer talks a lot about the persistence of the old regime, forces of order, forces of movement. And so that's going to be a little bit of our frame for today's episode. And just to kind of give a little bit of background for those of you who don't remember, although I can't imagine anyone who's forgotten about this, it was 187 minutes in the Capitol where Trump supporters stormed the House and Senate, egged on by Trump himself. in the sort of aftermath, the sort of like real news top headline stuff, is we've seen about 700% participants in the Capitol riot charged by the Department of Justice. People are now starting to get jail sentences. Oddly enough, no members of Congress who may or may not have been part of the Capitol riot have, you know, even really been indicted, have been indicted or even talked to. There's lots of news about the feds going after the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. We'd like to see the backs of the Proud Boys broken and the Oath Keepers broken, but still, you know, compared to like, to collaboration with members of Congress, that's like much more important. The other piece here is that like Trump still remains strong. He's still going strong in the Republican Party. 81% of Republicans in a recent Wall Street Journal poll actually say they still have a favorable impression of Trump. And a stunning 57% of Republicans say that they think that the election was stolen from Trump through widespread election fraud. Important thing to note is out of the whatever 150 million plus votes cast, only 500 of them have been found to be fraudulent. And then there's a lot of like sort of hand-wringing in liberal circles and establishment circles. Even recently in December, three generals penned a Washington Post op-ed lamenting the number of vets and active duty military involved in the riot. That being said, we just kind of want to have a little bit of a different conversation, but that's the sort of background, the media narrative that we're swimming in today.
Yeah, I think what we're going to hear, and we're going to hear a lot about this in the coming days, because the anniversaries and especially something like this are big, is going to be a repeat of just how awful, you know, and dangerous Trump and his people were. We now know more about it. You know, I think it was pretty clear that day that Trump was in some way orchestrating things, and we now have even more evidence toward that end, if not the so-called smoking gun. And, you know, we're going to see a lot of media attention on how evil that Trump is, how bad the Republicans are, how they've all fallen in lockstep. All of that's true. I mean, it's absolutely true, and it can't be downplayed. But I think one thing that we want to talk about even more is, I mean, it's kind of easy to go after Trump. He's an obvious target, and what they did, they didn't really hide it. I mean, Navarro went on Bannon's show and basically boasted about their strategy to you know, monkey wrench and overturn the election, which never had a chance to succeed, which was the point of our show last year. And I think it's still important to understand. It was a scary day. There's a lot of dangerous shit going down. Donald Trump wasn't going to be president, right? That doesn't mean that, you know, everybody could relax. And unfortunately, I think that's kind of the problem. I think one of the things I want to talk about today, we both want to talk about today, isn't really how bad Trump and the GOP are, because that's like doing a show about hell and talking about how evil Satan is. It's not hard to do, and it's pretty obvious, and it doesn't really tell you a lot. What I think is important is to understand in that moment just how horrific things had gotten, how unstable things had gotten, how even the ruling class, corporations, the military had to step in because of the instability, and how the Democratic Party was given an incredible opportunity. And not surprisingly for people we call the Washington Generals of Politics, really didn't act on this. And if I may brag for a moment, last year, late at night on January 5th, it may have been January 6th already after midnight, but the results from the two Georgia elections had come in. And Ralph Warnock and John Ossoff had been elected, the two Democrats, in a campaign where really Trump monkey wrenched it. But what was ironic is the entire Republican campaign that year, and they're running against one candidate who's Jewish and one who's African-American, right? In Georgia, a deep Southern state. And their entire campaign was, they're going to defund the police and they're socialists. And you know what? They won. So this was huge, I think. And it was a real message that, you know, if you stand by your, you know, stick by your guns, you can win this. And so that night, as those results came in, I, you know, was celebrating a little bit just because I'm not a big fan of electoral politics. But, you know, seeing Trump defeated obviously made me feel good. And so I just wrote some random, what I called Lafroy-infused thoughts. And my first one, which I'm kind of proud of, which didn't really require any, like I wasn't Kreskin to figure this out, but I said, given developments in Georgia, the MAGA charge of San Juan Hill tomorrow could be a gift to the Democrats if they play it right. And then in parentheses, I wrote, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think that's still my main response to all this. The Democrats were handed the biggest fucking political gift you could imagine. People invaded the Capitol violently, carrying Confederate flags, killing cops, attacking cops, going into Pelosi's office, stealing shit, you know. And at this point, no one's, you know, some small functionaries have kind of gotten some sentences for it. But Cruz and Hawley and Cotton and Gosar and Gates and Jordan and whatever, right? All of them, McCarthy, you name it. They're walking. They're unrepentant. They're, you know, they were never challenged. The Democratic Party has dragged its feet. We are now 1 year in, and they're still issuing subpoenas and toying with this commission, and the GOP could very well run out the clock. So I would start by saying that it was a crisis wasted unless things change rapidly. And that could be, you know, a fatal flaw, because I'm far more uneasy now about not necessarily fascism, but about a really ugly turn, a really more ugly turn than I was last year.
Yeah, and there was actually a poll that just came out that say that one that says like a third of Americans say that violence against the government is sometimes justified. And then the other thing with this poll, it's a Washington Post, University of Maryland post, is that there are 19%, who I'm going to guess are mostly Republicans, who see that the Capitol riot was actually mostly peaceful, and another 27% say that it was equally peaceful and violent. If you watch the footage from it, you obviously are going to have like different views on that. And that's footage from the people who are actually participating in it. That's almost 50%, 50% of Americans who actually, you know, see that, you know, are buying the propaganda put out by the Republicans, partially, mostly because there is no opposition party to contest that. And then there's a third of folks who think that, if we did have to use violence to overturn a stolen election, even though there's no evidence that this election was actually even stolen, that like that's totally, they're totally good with that. And if we look at those numbers just with Republicans, it's like, you know, 80% or more, right? And while I don't think Republicans are necessarily fascists or even want to be seen as fascists, you know, they see themselves on the same team as like some of these people who are like supporting, you know, violence where people got killed, trying to stop this like performative ceremony of, you know, certifying the president, et cetera, certifying Biden. And so it's just kind of something to keep in mind is that what Bob is saying is that, you know, we're in a moment where, you know, things are becoming more rationalized. And, you know, while we may not be heading towards a coup or a fascism, we're definitely looking at something, a much uglier time in our future.
Yeah, and I mean, from the beginning, there really wasn't resistance. And we've talked about this all the time. We talked about our end of the year show. You know, there were all kinds of groups ready to go on election day, you know, assuming that Trump was going to do something crazy. But it was very clear by that night that Biden was going to win. And it was, you know, kind of official a couple of days later. And they all stood down. And the Democratic Party stood down. And if you read the books about Trump that have come out recently, it kind of confirmed what we were saying at the time. Everybody in the White House said, you know, like they were avoiding him. Everybody knew, including Meadows, including Jared Kushner, that he'd lost. But basically, you have Giuliani and Powell and, you know, Flynn and a few other
Lynn Wood,
right? And the Democratic Party gave that oxygen. You know, their basic line was, and this has been their strategy toward Trump all the time, you know, like, just let it go, let him defeat himself. And, you know, I kind of get that. But at the same time, you know, Trump began talking about how the election was stolen. What's really ironic about this, too, though, is the people who stopped him in his tracks were his own people. Republican judges, some appointed by him. The Republicans in Georgia, I mean, if there's a, I hate to say a profile in courage, but if anybody stood up to Trump, it was the Georgia Republicans. It was Kemp, and I forget the name of the lieutenant governor there. Brad Raffensperger. And even last week they came out and said of the 5,000 votes, the 5,000 alleged fraudulent votes, they found four, you know, and I think a couple of them were votes for Republicans. So, you know, the Trump's own people, Wall Street, Republican judges, Republican state officials, the military, you know, all these forces for, you know, we talked about the forces of order. Arno Mayer pointed out that, like, whenever you have this kind of civil crisis, you have two different groups. You have the forces of movement, which is generally the left or liberals or progressives, whatever you want to call them, people who want to change things. Then you have the forces of order who want to keep things the same. And Mayer was talking about Europe in the 19th and early 20th centuries, but he talked about the persistence of the old regime. So the old regime can take blows. And I think in the summer of 2020, it did, but it has the capacity to absorb those. And in 2020, we saw a lot of strategies. We saw especially this kind of co-optation and preemption strategy where all these corporations began hanging Black Lives Matters and having, you know, scholarships and, you know, all this kind of stuff. The Democratic Party ran away, you know, talked about, you know, it talked about race and things like that to get votes. It had Kamala Harris was the vice presidential nominee to reach out, especially to these groups, to women and to African-Americans. But it really bailed at that point, right? It engaged in these performative actions. But when it came time to issues like, you know, the police or, you know, creating, you know, more funding for schools, more funding for education, more funding for healthcare, it ran away and it left the field. So it essentially accepted all the assumptions of the old regime. And Biden was clear on that, right? Nothing's going to fundamentally change. And so the old regime was able to absorb the blow of, you know, millions of people in the streets because it knew it was transient, you know, and you could create more stability. And that was a destabilizing event. And that's why Trump was dangerous, because he had destabilized. I mean, the United States at that point, the rest of the world was looking at the U.S. in horror. And that affects investment, that affects trade, that affects tourism. That affects, you know, just the general way that the rest of the world looks at you. The U.S. no longer has the kind of hegemony it did, let's say, after World War II. The U.S. is still a major, powerful country with the biggest military and the biggest economy. But, you know, clearly the Chinese now are ascending. And, you know, the rest of the world doesn't rely on the U.S. the way it did. And so the events of 2020 really, I think we're saying to the rest of the world, this is a failed state. And the ruling class had to step in because of the action in the streets. And unfortunately, that ended it, right? They engaged in these strategies of co-optation and preemption very successfully. They got rid of Trump. I mean, they did create, you know, we talked to Alex Vitale. We've seen some reform on policing. You know, some cities have created new groups to deal with mental health crises instead of sending armed officers out. You know, there's been some movement there, but realistically, I mean, the system absorbed that shock. The forces of order remained in power. The old regime, you know, bent a little bit, made a few changes. You know, for a time there, it was actually, I think, moving back toward a kind of a system of corporate liberalism, you know, instead of neoliberalism. And I'm not sure that's the case anymore either. So it's not even a mixed bag. I think it was a temporary transient response to a massive uprising by the forces of movement. And then, you know, a quick retrenching. And now I think we're back to, you know, where we were before.
And just to put it out there, just as around the sort of ruling class co-optation, is that, you know, the movement's after the police murder of George Floyd, like Bob said, you know, we saw at Whole Foods, they were hanging Black Lives Matter signs, banners off of their like storefronts. We saw a lot of corporations come out with, you know, language and policy, a lot of response to like social media gotchas of employees or executives who, like, you know, were saying offensive, fucked up things. And then on the day of the Capitol riot, the ruling class moved in quickly to sort of co-opt the sort of anti-Trump message there too. We saw Jamie Dimon, the CEOs of Goldman Sachs, Citibank, Bank of America, all follow suit, the big tech companies. Just to give you a flavor, Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, largest money manager in the world, called the attack on the Capitol an assault on our nation, our democracy, and the will of the American people. The peaceful transfer of power is the foundation of our democracy. We are who we are as a nation because of our democratic institutions and processes. And so they also recognize that these shocks to the system, you know, were a big threat to them. And they had to come out with language and a limited time policies to sort of counter what the far right and what Trump were doing. We've talked about that a bunch of times on this show, but you know, there were a number of corporations, many corporations who came out and said that they would stop giving donations to Republicans who had voted to decertify the results of the election. But you know, 2 months later, you know, they were back to giving money to those politicians.
Yeah. And I think that again speaks to that issue. I mean, the ruling class played a vital role in that week, in that entire period, really from the election through the inaugural. And at that point, you know, the pressure subsided. That they did that because there were 20 million people in the streets. Some of them were throwing bricks through their windows, you know. And you know, the ruling class can squish people if it wanted to, right? It could control. You know, I mean, well, although I think what's really interesting, and Milley stands out in this, and I've often been accused of being soft on military leaders because that's kind of what I study. And, you know, that's
I always think of you as soft on the military.
Yeah. I mean, you know, these guys aren't lefties, but they have a vital role to play in society. And Milley was terrified of Trump, you know, no doubt, because Trump had shown so much disrespect for the military, which is kind of ironic, right? Because as a lefty, you know, that's kind of, you know, our thing, right? But, you know, when Milley and the military, you know, said, no, we're not going to do this. And when Dick Cheney got a circular letter from 10 ex-defense secretaries, and when, you know, Liz Cheney kind of became the voice of resistance, you know, it was clear that something was happening. And the Democratic Party and the resistance kind of took that, and it was important, was vitally important in that period from November 2nd or 3rd, whenever election was, until, well, at least January 6th or beyond, right? But then it stopped, and I don't know, I'm not privy to what was going on in Washington, but that continued for a bit. Remember when the Georgia voting law was being, the new Georgia voting law was being debated,
Major League Baseball,
Major League Baseball pulled the All-Star game. A bunch of corporations came out against it, but there was no corresponding political action from liberals, from Democrats, from the left, right? And so in that, you know, in that moment, these ruling class institutions, these banks and corporations, they go, oh, what the hell? We can do whatever we want. You know, like in the summer, we had pressure on us. They were throwing bricks through our windows. Now they're not doing anything. So we can put on this performative action. We can say we believe in voting rights, blah, blah, blah. Because we're going to get what we want no matter what. I mean, it could be a Democrat, it could be a Republican. It doesn't matter who Bernie Sanders could have been president, Wall Street would have been fine, right? So once they realized that pressure had gone, it had disappeared, they could go back to just saying, yeah, we'll give every money to everybody. We'll give money to Ted Cruz. We'll give money to Tom Cotton. We'll give money to Josh Hawley. We're going to hedge every bet we have because, you know, when the time comes, we want people who are, you know, on our side. They'll donate to Biden and Harris. They'll donate to Buttigieg. They'll donate to Schumer and
It should be noted that the Republican fundraising, even in January of 2021, was not adversely affected by the Capitol riot and or by the, you know, corporate PACs, political action committees saying they're going to pull donations to certain Republican politicians. Hawley actually had in January of 2021 raised more money than he had ever raised in any month before. And I'll you know, a lot of that's going to be from crazy Fox News watchers, et cetera, but still,
oh, yeah, a lot of it was.
Important thing that it's important to note that we're not going to bankrupt them
No. And I think in the initial couple months, I think the small donations from the Fox News OAN types really did. But yeah, I mean, you know, corporations, if you know, they have to be forced to do something, and it's not going to be based on altruism. It's just going to be kind of like, you know, if you don't do this, we're going to continue to make your life difficult like we did last summer. And you know, the Democratic Party was never part of this either. They benefited from it. You know, they benefited from Trump's incompetence on COVID, which they've matched. They benefited from Trump's insane approach to the streets where he wanted to blow people up, which really turned off even like, you know, middle-class suburban, you know, suburban women, right? When he's attacking the wall of moms and things like that. So it's, you know, we also saw, I think, which was somewhat encouraging that, you know, we've been for years now kind of given this alarm about the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and the extreme right. And I'm not diminishing their threat. They're scary people. They're also paper tigers. I mean, they went down pretty easily last year. The FBI infiltrated them. They're snitching on each other. Every time there's been a confrontation, whether it be in Minneapolis or Portland or Seattle, the number of people like Antifa or just counter protesters always outnumbers them and generally sends them driving away. And that's something else I think that was important to come out of that. In terms of sheer numbers, we overwhelmed them. And we saw that in the summer of 2020. But the Republicans will embrace the most odious neo-Nazi, white supremacist, batshit crazy people in their camp. And whereas the Democratic Party runs away from anybody who, you know, may have the temerity to throw a shoe, you know, at an elected official or throw a rotten tomato at a bank, you know, they live in this world. And Biden said this, remember, I'm going to reach out and we're going to have bipartisanship and civility. And, you know, it's okay to say that. But like after a week, you know, I mean, Mitch McConnell made it clear from the start, we're not going to vote for anything. We're not going to do anything. We're not going to give you any judge, you know, Supreme Court judge. Like it wasn't even like something he had to figure out. They made it clear, we're not going to cooperate with you. And Biden continued to do that. I don't like making jokes about the guy's mental acuity or his age or anything like that. I think those are cheap. But he's not the sharpest tool, right? And the lack of energy, the just kind of sloppiness and the inability to respond is really quite frightening right now. I think there's just the GOP has maintained the initiative despite what they did on January 6th. I mean, that should have been like a world historical moment where the party kind of was just destroyed, as some Republicans predicted, right? And in fact, it's ready now to just win big in 2022. And a lot of that, you can bitch all you want about the GOP and how fucked up they are and how dangerous they are. But when you don't have an opposition taking you on, then that's Clausewitz. You know, Clausewitz said, the people who fight back start the war, right? Well, Democrats haven't started the war because they don't fight back, you know?
Yeah, they don't want to go to war. They just want
I also, that day, to brag again, but I wrote after I said, given developments, you know, what's the charge up San Juan Hill? Then I said, the Senate might be 50-50, but Manchin and Sinema with a big ellipsis. And I think that's a big part of it too. And again, you know, we're not privy to what's going on behind the scenes, but it doesn't seem like there's been a big pressure campaign on Manchin and Sinema. And it's really quite remarkable how Manchin has just essentially become Trump's campaign manager. I mean, the way he's doing this is just really quite something. And I know that's something you worked on a long time. You're familiar with the politics of coal. And at the end of the day, trying to figure out why Manchin is doing this, what his motivation is, I don't really have a good idea, but I keep kind of coming back to that. Remember, we've talked about the lumpen oligarchy before. I mean, that's Manchin's background, right? He's a coal baron, you know?
I mean, when we talk about the persistence of the old regime, that's like the old regime, right?
The old extractive industries, yeah.
It's not just like capital, it's like industry and it's extraction.
And, oh, more so, yeah.
And very much Manchin is, you know, rooted in that. He owns his own, you know, coal processing operations. he's taken money from the coal barons, the real arch coal barons, the Blankenships and the all the other players in Appalachia, et cetera, and other parts of the world. And you know, he also takes money from this dark money from like the Koch networks as well, who are, you know, very much rooted in laissez-faire politics or economics. And then also, you know, fossil fuel extraction, like they're that's oil money. And so it's like an important thing just to note. Go ahead.
Right before we came on, I looked up some, and I quickly looked up some of Manchin's contributions. So this is from, I think, the last two cycles, 1918, 1920. So securities and investments gave him $1.1 million.
And we've got 2018 and 2020.
Not in 2020, yeah.
Yeah.
And
Cole, 100 years ago, probably was giving money to him, too. So.
Well, lawyers, the legal industry has given him $900,000. And then oil and gas. $763,000. Now he also has $5.2 million invested in coal, or like, you know, those are his assets. So he's definitely a coal baron. As he began to take on the Biden agenda, there was a big surge in donations from those particular extractive industries and Republican, like the Koch brothers too. He got $400,000 in fossil fuel funds just from mid-2021 to October. So in about a 3 or 4 month period, right? So, you know, he represents these old extractive industries. And I saw a piece today, I forget where it was, about steel, which is kind of similar to coal. China now dominates global steel production. It's just overwhelmingly, it produces more steel than the rest of the world combined. And I believe in terms of coal now, the United States is where the U.S. is not by far the leading coal producer. And where is it, like third or fourth now? Or
yeah, somewhere down. It's China's
top. China, Australia.
Australia's up there.
Is Chile, or isn't there a Latin American country or a South American country? It doesn't matter. But the point is, the U.S., we're dealing with these old industries that are dying, coal and, you know, I've talked many times about being from Youngstown, Ohio, which is just a ghost town, right? And coal is much the same. And you know, Biden and his people represent kind of the last stand of these folks. Because you would think like Build Back Better, right? That's $1.75 trillion over 10 years. So it's $175 billion. Now, West Virginia would get a cut of that. And West Virginia would use that money to create jobs. And Manchin presumably could say, look what I did, right? Okay, so we have, what is this? This is coal. So yeah. China, 3.7 billion tons, that's metric tons. India, 783. So that's like less than a third, right? So, and the US below that. So you would think that this Build Back Better money, you know, would be a political asset, right? Manchin could go to ribbon cutting ceremonies. He could say, look what I got you. We have a new school. We have a new clinic. We have better roads. We have internet, whatever, right? I mean, we have, I still have trouble believing this. I read it. 25% of the people in West Virginia have no teeth. And Biden and Manchin is against including dental in Medicare for all. He's against, that's his line in the sand, is that you have to stop those $300 a month child credits, right? And he's the senator from the poorest state in the country, right? He says they'll just go out and use it on drugs. Ironic, because his daughter is the CEO of Mylan and worked for Pfizer, which gouges people on EpiPen. So if anybody should know drug abuse, it's Joe Manchin and his family. But, you know, it's just weird, isn't it, right? Because you would think that this would be a campaign asset, right? You could go there and say, you know, look at the money we've got. We're bringing in because of my vote, you know, like take credit for it. I told Joe Biden, other than I don't get it. I don't understand it. I also did a couple months ago, I looked up some job data number and with regard to coal, because I don't know. I mean, I can't understand what Manchin's motive is, because he's really monkey wrenching this whole thing. And this ties in directly. I mean, you have the failure to address the events of January 6th, and now the failure to create an agenda
to take people to distract people from your failures. But in the United States, there are about 44,000 coal jobs. And in West Virginia, there's about 14,000, right? Comparatively, that's 14,000 coal jobs in West Virginia, 44,000 nationally. Comparatively, Amazon has 1.3 million employees. Walmart has 1.6 million employees. McDonald's has 210,000, but 1.9 million if you include franchised employees. Olive Garden, my favorite Italian restaurant. If you want really good Italian food, that's where you go, right? Has 95,000, which is, six times more than West Virginia coal. Burger King, 34,000. Starbucks, 349,000 employees. Target, 409,000 employees. So we are dealing with an industry that is, these extractive industries, they're dying. They're not that critical financially, importantly, and economically. And yet, Manchin is monkey wrenching, the entire economy and Biden. And, you know, Manchin is essentially, there is a clear connection, right? Manchin is legitimating January 6th. Manchin is enabling January 6th to continue to have oxygen. And in the absence of some kind of alternative, which Biden hasn't really presented, COVID is a disaster. The CDC is now basically throwing up its hands. I believe the CDC did say, however, that you should listen to the Green Red podcast, didn't it? Isn't that part of its new guidelines?
Yeah, it came out with the Omicron guidelines.
Which
suggests when you're quarantined in a home, listen to the Green and Red podcast, which many people are doing now. So
yeah,
the only thing I'll say is that I feel like there's where we've had this sort of neoliberal project for like the last 40 years in American government, moving towards austerity, cutting budgets, fighting unions, all of that sort of thing. And I feel like for a long time, we've been hearing we're in the last gasps of that project, which I don't think is true at this point. And Manchin is just another in a long line of flunkies for that as well, for those who want to continue to slash budgets, slash social services, and just push everyone into like working at all these different corporate retail outlets or whatever. And at this point, big coal, big fossil fuels are paying for Manchin to do that.
And Manchin catches justifiably catches a lot of the flack and a lot of the shit he should. But this is Joe Biden's party. And Biden hasn't exactly, all this rhetoric when he came in about the new FDR, the new LBJ. And, something I saw today, which is really a bad omen, I think, for the Democratic Party, is if they need more. In Michigan, the rep last year, Fred Upton, I forget which district, voted for Trump's impeachment and was really critical of Trump. So he was kind of a progressive Republican, a sane Republican. And he was replaced by Peter Meyer from the Meyer grocery store chain. And Meyer represented himself that way too. I'm different, and he criticized Trump. Today he came out and said, Trump is our only alternative because Biden has just become like this radical JFK, FDR, LBJ type. And so we have to stick with Trump. This is amazing. In the aftermath of January 6th, where I don't like to use the word fascist, but if you want to, fine. And January 6th, you saw violent political extremists from the right, and call them whatever you want, white supremacists, you want to call them, I don't care what you call it. The fact is you saw hardcore, unrepentant, angry, violent extremists from the right with direction from the highest levels of government attack the government, right? And they've gotten away with it, whereas, a few people on the Republican Party have thrown out the words they're socialist or they're radicals or they're communist, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, all these lunatics. And it's stuck. I've talked to people here who are not dumb, who genuinely believe that Biden and Harris are some kind of radical left, right? And that, like, so people who've actually violently attacked the Capitol are skating, right? Whereas people who
are seen as peaceful,
But this narrative that the Democratic Party is being run by, you know, the Politburo and Hugo Chavez and all this crazy shit, seem, you know, and the Democrats won't engage it. They never have. The Democrats have always gone after their left far more than the right, beating Bernie Sanders, you know, stepping back. You know, I'm not, the squad is limited, right? And I'm not going to turn them into heroes. A lot of people on the left want to turn them into rock stars and heroes. And at the same time, like, I have no issue with AOC. She's one of five or six people who are trying to do something. She has a great following. Young people follow her, you know, but the realistically, I mean, you are dealing with a small, tiny, tiny fringe, and the party leaders, the elders like Pelosi and the rest, want to squish them, right? So you have Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Boebert. You have criminals and pedophiles and all kinds of, you know, father rapers and mother stabbers and, you know, mother rapers and father stabbers. QAnon people who are very much at home in the Republican Party. And then with the Democrats, you know, Bernie Sanders is an outcast. They're still blaming him for 2016. AOC gets attacked. Al Franken was booted. Katie Hill was booted. You're talking about one side that's unilaterally disarmed itself and the other side, which is playing with every weapon and without any rules. And at the end of the day, I think, and you can speak to this, it gets back to what we've always said, which is these guys aren't going to save us. And so we need to figure out alternatives. And, you know, we're seeing some of that. We're seeing mutual aid. We're seeing protest organizing, union organizing. We're going to need to see some kind of a major grassroots abortion access movement, you know, a national version of like Jane, which occurred in the 1960s in Chicago. But, you know, the Democratic Party, I mean, they've never codified Roe v. Wade, so they're not going to do anything now, right?
Yeah, I think that kind of the important question to me in this moment is, you know, the 2016 election, the 2020, the 2018, the 2020 election, looking forward to the 2022, 2024 elections, is that, you know, a lot of people who do work in their communities, who do movement work, do movement organizing in these critical moments in the election. I did this. Like, I have considered myself an anarchist for 20 years, and I still did text banking for, you know, for Biden, and because I thought it was that important to get rid of Trump. But like, we continue to, you know, play politics and play organizing in the system. You know, we were ready to hit the street, you know, the day after the election, and, you know, operatives within the Democratic Party did everything they could to shut that down. A lot of us still went out and did stuff. I personally went out and did actions at Twitter headquarters. I took over the street in front of one of Trump's law firms in downtown San Francisco and, you know, did a lot of action and media, caught a lot of media around that. But I think that the real question for me, there's two questions. One is, how much more do we want to organize within this sort of particular beltway systemic approach versus, like, you know, mutual aid actually is bigger than it's ever been before, mostly because of the pandemic and people responding to the pandemic. You know, we've, in the last few years, we've seen like these massive teacher strikes in West Virginia, Kentucky, and Los Angeles, where we're seeing teachers actually get a lot of things that they're asking for. We've also seen, you know, the climate movement take off in unprecedented sort of ways. And so, you know, with labor and with the climate movement in particular, and those are two of which I'm more familiar with, is it still seemed to come back to, let's do a sit-in in Pelosi's office. Let's put pressure on our politicians. And how much do we want to organize within this system, which continues to ignore us, versus like building up a whole lot more power to even topple the system and definitely like displace it. That's one question. And the two is like, what are the strategies around that? And we've had a number of people on the show talk about different organizing strategies, even national organizing strategies. But I mean, I feel like that is the most important question. And a lot of folks within the organizing left, you know, everyone immediately jumps to tactics and they never actually talk about what's some of the bigger strategies, but some of the grander strategies that we can begin to sort of, like, you know, Manchin is only able to do what he's able to do because we've allowed the system to like elevate him to the point where he can do that. And I have personally tactically disrupted Joe Manchin's speaking events in West Virginia around Cole 15 years ago. I just want to say that we need to like have a little bit more of a group conversation about what to do different, because what we're doing now is not working. The earth is just being destroyed. We're in a new gilded age. You know, employers are fighting against union and strikes really hard. We're very much moving back to the way we were 100 or 150 years ago. So I just want to throw that out there. Those two questions are about how much longer do we want to organize within the confines of the system? And then two, you know, what are the strategies to not do that, to move us outside of that?
I mean, if you're talking about elections, you have 10 months right now, you know, and with massive barriers. I mean, at this point, the GOP is going to win in a bloodbath. And, you know, so what do you do? Do you continue to work? There's no real resistance in the Democratic Party. Nancy Pelosi, when she finally gives up her position, is going to be replaced by Hakeem Jeffries. So you're replacing a San Francisco liberal elite with a Manhattan liberal elite, coastal elites, right? Which is kind of the entire thing. That's a gift to the GOP, right? The Democratic Party is run by coastal elites. And what do? You go from San Francisco to Manhattan, right? It's
the leader of the Senate's from Manhattan. So
they're trying to lose. It's as if, you know, at least before the Harry Reid, who died recently, you know, I mean, I'm not a big fan of mainstream politicians, but Harry Reid knew how to fight. You know, he could do something. But the Democrats are trying to lose. They are the Washington Generals. The last thing, like, because I'm saying about what I wrote last year, a year ago. And the last thing I wrote when I on my like late night scotch induced ruminations was, lefties, you can bitch about the Democrats from now until you find a real unicorn, but they don't care. Spare your anger and your time and do something meaningful, like get involved in movement politics, participatory democracy, organizing, activism, mutual aid, whatever. None of us is served well by bitching about the Democrats being Democrats. They're not changing. They don't care about the left, and the squad is a nice little token of their political diversity to them. 30 million people in the streets have leverage. The squad doesn't. Election's over. Now it's time for politics. Think globally, guillotine locally. So those were my final thoughts last year, the day before the mob, you know, rushed the Bastille. But I would say pretty much the same thing today. The events of January 6th should have created an entire new political dynamic in which the GOP was like discredited. And part of that is because we have a lot of fucked up people in this country, which scares me. You know, Trump got 75 million votes. And there's a lot to that that I don't really understand. But a big part of that is because there was no opposition. There remains no opposition. There is no aggressive challenge. And I think, you know, at some point, what did Martin Luther King say? Long after we forget the angry words of our enemies, we'll remember the silence of our friends. And that's kind of what we're seeing now. So I think if there's a legacy of January 6th, it's that the forces of movement, which really aren't the forces of movement, they're the forces of order, which temporarily kind of became forces of liberation, but they kind of just stopped in their tracks. And the old regime is always going to be ruthless in defending its interests.
Well, those forces of movement, which, you know, represented by the Democratic Party, turned on the actual forces of movement, which were the left, the street left.
Exactly.
People on the street.
I mean, if I've been saying this for years, I mean, I'm not the only person. A lot of people have been saying this years. If a political party managed to create a legitimate healthcare system, like a public healthcare system, that party would win elections for like the next decades, right? And the Democratic Party like immediately put an end to that amid a global pandemic, which exposed just how destroyed and destructive the medical system in the United States is. I mean, and that was the Democratic Party actively attacking that system, right? You know, and look at people now, they have all these debts, people have COVID, you know, debts, you have the hospital system is in disarray, you know, you can't get people vaccinated, you can't convince people to get vaccinated.
It's
can't get, you can't get tests.
You can't get tests. You know, to go back to the show we did on Cuba with the lunatics, like A New Politics and that voice attacking the Cubans. Right now, you're way better off in Cuba, right? I mean, they have COVID tests. They have a COVID vaccine. The United States is a what did Trump call them? Shithole countries. The United States is a shithole country. You know, it's horrific. And, you know, and now the CDC is making it worse. You know, Omicron may not be as virulent, but the numbers are so big, you're still going to see a lot of people get sick. And we need to do a show on that, you know, soon with our public health correspondent, consultant, because, COVID, they've kind of wished it away. Like it just disappeared, right? It's not a thing anymore. Well, you know, there's a lot of people still dying, you know? So, yeah, there's a lot. And January 6th, unfortunately, is, I don't know how, you know, years from now people are going to look at it, but in the short term, I think they got away with it. I mean, I really do. I think they're going to walk. I think Cruz and Holly and Cotton are going to use this as presidential campaign issues. You know, I don't think anything's going to happen to Jim Jordan or Gosar or Gates or Boebert or any of those people. You know, you're going to see some lower level like Proud Boy people, you know, they'll go to jail, but Trump won't be touched. And, you know, actually, I wouldn't be surprised if the GOP just runs out the clock. And, you know, once they take over the House, all these things will just be disbanded. So it's pretty foreboding. I'm way more bleak than I was in 2021. It's a horrible time. Horrible people are doing horrible things. Other people tell you they love you and they care about you. And as soon as they get what they want, they kick you to the curb. So it's a dark time. It's the other day I brought out that Bertolt Brecht poem, To Those Born Later. And if you haven't read it, you should look it up. To Those Born Later, or sometimes To Those Born After, where Brecht talks about, you know, kind of the failure to stop the Nazis. And the last line is very moving, you know, to those of us, you know, we failed, you know, but to those of us, you know, who look upon us, please look upon us with forbearance. And I mean, there are people fighting back right now, but, and they're doing a hell of a job, but we need a lot more of that. I think it's easy for us being podcast to tell people what to do, but I think, you and I have also actually gone out and done things too. And we try to engage people.
I'm doing it now.
Yeah. I mean, we're bringing people on who talk about that, you know? So, it's a dark time. It's a dark time. And January 6th, I mean, you know, it's not too late though. That's the thing. You know, things can change. I mean, there are these rapid shifts. I mean, in early 2016, how many people would have predicted Donald Trump would be president, right? I mean, the odds were insane, right? He was still considered a joke. And then look what he did. I mean, the campaign he ran, I'm going to grab her. You could grab her pussy. You could do that. And he still won. So shit can happen. Time to go Bullworth, right? So.
Yeah, we're living in an unpredictable time for sure. I mean, in some ways it makes a lot of sense that we're seeing this persistence of the old regime where they're asserting themselves, because they have been thrown by both an invigorated left in many ways, whether it's the Sanders campaign or this sort of reinvigorated labor movement, et cetera, or, you know, the populist right of Trump. So, I mean, I personally make no predictions, but I think it's important that we need to kind of ground ourselves in movement organizing, mutual aid, direct action, all of that sort of things. Because in the very least, it's we don't sit around yelling at the internet, and we'll, you know, it will lead us out of at least a personal darkness until, you know, unless we get like completely crushed. So,
yeah. And on that happy note, Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy 2022. You've been listening to the Green and Red podcast, looking back on the Capitol riot. More importantly, like just a sort of like map of, you know, the way things are in our minds. This is Green and Red Podcast. You can check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can hit that subscribe button on YouTube, or you can go and make a donation if you really like us at greenandredpodcast.org and hit the support button, and or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. We'll talk to you again soon.
Raindrops keep falling on my head, and just like the guy's feet.